Defense Secretary Ashton Carter calls on Congress today to figure out a way to move on from sequestration. His nomination hearing today before the Senate Armed Services Committee included a discussion of sequester and a lot of other issues that we'll take up on today's Pentagon Solutions. Sean Brimley's Executive Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for a New American Security, and my guest on Pentagon Solutions, first one at least, CNAS releasing a briefing book for the next Secretary of Defense. Sean, it's great to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for joining me today. You start off this briefing book with very encouraging words about Dr. Carter and the experience that he'll bring to the job. Why do you think he's the right man to deal with what the Pentagon is up against right now? Thanks for being on, Sean.
Well, thanks for having me. No, I'm pretty excited and optimistic. I mean, I'm maybe young and naive here, but I am an internal optimist because I think, you know, first of all, he's inheriting a great team. Deputy Secretary Work's been there for over a year. Frank Kendall, Undersecretary for AT&L. He's got a great sort of uniformed counterpart in Dempsey and Vice Chairman Winnefeld. And he's got, I think, and you saw this today from the Senate Armed Services Committee, I think he's got the respect of Republican counterparts on the Hill, both on the House and the Senate. So if you're interested in sort of the Pentagon, if you're interested in sequestration being rolled back, if you're interested in a defense secretary who's really going to move the building in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, I think Secretary Carter is really going to, you know, help move the ball down the field here. So I'm actually pretty optimistic.
We've talked on this program on a number of occasions about the third offset strategy, and that's one of the elements that you write about in this publication, Ideas to Action, Suggestions for the 25th Secretary of Defense. And we have a link to it later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. What is your takeaway about the offset strategy, and why do you suggest investment on the part of Dr. Carter?
Well, I think when you actually, it's one of the reasons I'm optimistic is that there's got to be a real sense of urgency. So for the budget, you know, for the budgetary community, Dr. Carter is inheriting the FY16 budget submission that was just dropped on Capitol Hill earlier this week. So that's basically done. He's going to do a lot of testifying and supporting of that, but he didn't really help shape that for obvious reasons. The FY18 budget will be rolled out in February of 2017 after the new commander-in-chief takes office. So if you're Dr. Carter and you're interested in really materially moving the building, you've really got the FY17 budget build that's starting basically right now, and it is going to culminate 12 months from now when they release their FY17 proposal to Capitol Hill. So this is going to be a huge year for those of us watching the defense budget and defense procurement priorities. You know, there's going to be a new a decision on the long-range bomber, sort of the successor to the B-2 bomber. They've got to make decisions on carrier-based aircraft, the Ohio replacement program for our nuclear submarines. There's a lot of things that have to happen in the next 12 months. And so it's going to be a pretty dynamic year.
You've touched on a couple of those priorities, and I want to discuss some of those at greater length. But of the four priorities that you suggest for Dr. Carter, when and if he's confirmed as the next SecDef, the one that I find the most interesting and potentially hard to pin down is the emerging technologies one. And you write a number of new capabilities well along in their development: hypersonics, electromagnetics, directed energy, various aspects of cyber. And I keep hearing from expert after expert after expert that the next conflict will either start or be driven by some kind of cyber activity. And I think that's what makes it the hardest, not just for observers like us, but for people actually inside the building to pin down exactly how to get your arms around it. Is that a fair observation on my part, do you think?
No, I think that's right. And so I think one of the things we'll have to look at is sort of basic science and research and development spending. I think you will expect, I think the submission just recently adds dollars to that. Bob Work and Ash Carter, I think, have a very sort of, there's been a meeting of the minds on the need to sort of invest in these emerging technologies. And so I think you'll see a lot of progress. But, I mean, on the cyber point, I agree with you. One of the big challenges for my limited experience in the Pentagon was integrating cyberspace into contingency planning, into war planning, into the kind of defense scenarios that are really the building blocks for force structure. And I think we've made some positive progress over the last few years at integrating both cyber and space dimensions into that kind of contingency planning process.
Sean Brimley of the Center for a New American Security, my guest on the first part of Pentagon Solutions today, and your colleague Kate Kidder will join me in just a few minutes. When we talk about R&D and the squeeze that the defense industrial base feels, are the message message they're taking away, although it's certainly not intended by Secretary Kendall and others, the message the defense industrial base is getting is, we want you to essentially become our R&D arm, and we're not necessarily able to guarantee that if you spend a lot of money researching and developing weapons, you're going to be able to recoup that in sales to us, in revenue. Is it possible that having Dr. Carter there as a former ATL and now as a Secretary of Defense might be able to speak their language in a way that Secretary Kendall already is, but hearing it from multiple voices might kind of help calm down the defense industrial base a bit?
Yeah, the way I look at this issue is, I think the defense industry is looking for a real demand signal. They're sitting on a pile of cash that they're sort of paying out in dividends and sort of other things. They have money to invest. They will invest it if they make a calculation that what they're investing in is something that's actually responsive to Pentagon desires. I think their frustration is, for the last number of years, they haven't really gotten a sense of what the Pentagon really wants. Is it hypersonics? Is it directed energy? Is it unmanned, different kinds of long-range unmanned systems? Is it a penetrating bomber? If so, what does that look like? I think this Defense Innovation Initiative that Bob Work and Frank Kendall are ongoing, the sort of third offset strategy, is very conducive to where Ash Carter is. Remember, one of his big mentors is Bill Perry, a former secretary who is credited in the late 70s, early 80s with really pushing the Pentagon towards the precision strike and stealth and satellite revolution. So I think Dr. Carter, both from his past, but also the way that he will probably start even thinking now about his legacy. What does he want to be remembered for doing at the Pentagon? I think one of those priorities for him is going to be, he wants to be seen as a secretary who moved the ball, who invested in R&D, and who invested in the kind of technologies that are going to secure America's military technological edge, for decades to come.
I want to look at your priority list again and think about it in a budget context, because the most likely scenario, given what we've seen the last couple of years and given arguments most recently that Mike McCord made, is that we'll probably wind up somewhere in the middle of what the budget cap number calls for. That's the $498 billion, and the $534 billion that's in the budget request that came out yesterday. Is the key element to that, in your mind, that whatever the number's going to be, even if it's the 498, that the Defense Department know that's exactly what the number's going to be and that sequestration's not going to affect them by October 1st of this year, and if they get the 498, they can figure out how to make it work?
I think that's absolutely right. I think if you had people like Frank Kendall or Bob Work on the phone with you, they would say what they really need is certainty. Mm-hmm. The problem is the cloud of uncertainty forces the Pentagon to spend just gobs of time building out in detail all sorts of different, all sorts of different budget scenarios, and it just eats away at any bandwidth to do anything else. And so you've basically got a bunch of people scrambling in the Pentagon writing 10 different, budget scenarios.
Yeah.
When if there's some clarity and they can focus on one, they can really focus their effort on making sure that the hard choices that would have to be made are the right ones, and there's all sorts of analysis to back up those choices. If they have that uncertainty, they're not going to be able to build any particular budget scenario in any real strategic depth.
You have, in the time we have left, the detail in your briefing book is terrific, and there's a lot here. And as you say, there's a limited amount of time, even if Dr. Carter is working right up until 11:59 a.m., January 20th, 2017, and he's not asked to stay on by the next administration, he does have a limited amount of time. Are there some of the key things that you and your team write about in this briefing book that if he were to achieve or make progress with, and not so much in others, we would still consider his tenure a success?
Yes, I think if he manages to make the rebalance to Asia real, invest in that, that's something that I think will echo, for decades to come. If he makes sure the Pentagon can invest in some, big, these new program starts, invest, recapitalize the ballistic missile submarines, make a decision on long-range bomber, while at the same time, doing all the other things the defense secretary has to do, participate in the policy discussions, do all the big defense bilaterals, all of that is a critical element of his tenure. But I think, historians will look back on his tenure and they will gravitate towards what were the particular choices that he made and he influenced. And I think when you think about Asia, when you think about the defense budget, those are the kinds of things I think that will echo through history, not the sort of the tyranny of the inbox crises that sort of perpetuate the day to day.